Welcome back to the third hour of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Audio open lines in just a few minutes. Pastor Walt Snyder will join us to talk about Philip the Deacon. He's remembered by the church on this day. It occurs to me that one of the things you don't often get as listeners to be exposed to, you hear people call into the program or email the program, but you don't get to read the mail that we get to read. We call them listener testimonials, for lack of a better word. And we get some criticism. We also get an awful lot of people who deeply appreciate what we're doing here at Issues, Etc. Here's one. This one comes from a pastor in Gillette, Wyoming. He says, I just wanted to write you a quick note and inform you that our church, Trinity Lutheran Church in Gillette, Wyoming, will be sending you our midweek school offerings to Issues, Etc. this school year. You're going to receive a check at the end of the year and again in May. Keep up the good work. The show is great. This is the kind of support that we need here at Issues, Etc. In fact, think about this. Is Issues, Etc. part of your congregation's advertising or mission budget? It really should be. We've put together a printable flyer at our website that you can use. You can take it to your pastor, to your board of elders, to your mission board, to whatever board you have that handles these kind of things at your congregation. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and you will find there on the homepage a link to this printable form that tells you everything you need to know about making your congregation part of your congregation's advertising or mission budget, Issues, Etc. And a little bit lower than that, if you're interested, you'll find a link to more of those listener testimonials that we've put up there. Look for the logo of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Click the link, print off the flyer that we have for your congregation, telling them about the benefits of putting Issues, Etc. in their advertising or mission budget, and bring it to your pastor, to your elders, and to your mission board. Now, we're right in the middle of this National Public Radio story about what they're calling foreign bishops, and the term that they're using, I mentioned this before the break, the reaction of the Episcopal Church USA's leadership and hierarchy is this is an invasion as far as they're concerned. This is an incursion into their territory. And make no mistake about it, they're not putting up with this. Anglicans are known for their long-suffering patience. They're known for not getting riled up, but what riles up Catherine Jefferts Schori and the other liberal bishops in the Episcopal Church USA? When these devout and conservative bishops from Africa and other countries extend their protection to devout Anglicans in the United States, they call it an invasion, an incursion. Back to the story from National Public Radio.
The foreign clerics have cut a wide swath, absorbing churches from Florida to California and Massachusetts to Texas. Among them is All Saints in Woodbridge, one of 12 churches in Virginia to leave the Episcopal Church in the past year. I showed up on a Wednesday night and asked Chris Brown and Mary Wang about it. They said they're thrilled.
Are you going to learn a little Ugandan?
Oh, we know a little bit.
Tukutandereza, Yesu, Yesu, Olamwana, Gwendika.
In December, All Saints voted 402-6 to align with Uganda. They even got a bishop out of it, their minister, John Guernsey. Guernsey was consecrated bishop in Uganda on September 2nd. Anglican TV cameras rolled as this Virginia minister pledged his allegiance to Archbishop Arambe.
Are you persuaded that you are truly called to this administration according to the will of our Lord Jesus Christ? I am so persuaded.
Guernsey told us it's a logical step.
That God would call me to be a missionary bishop now, in some wonderful way, seems to make all the sense in the world.
The ceremony marked Uganda's formal move into the United States, placing Guernsey over 34 U.S. congregations. And that's only a small part of the incursion. Nigeria has 6 parishes, Kenya 20, South America 60, Rwanda more than 100. Ian Douglas, a theologian at Episcopal Divinity School in Massachusetts, says every time a foreign bishop plants a flag in American territory,
it raises the question of who is the real leader and what is the real church.
Which in turn has legal implications, since the national church and disaffected churches are fighting about who owns the church property. So far, these breakaway churches are only a fraction of the 7,600 Episcopal churches. But the trickle is turning into a robust stream. Four American bishops are taking steps to move their entire diocese to foreign provinces. And ultimately, these alliances could change the face of the second largest denomination in the world. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
Now, this is the second time that you've heard on these airwaves about Bishop Guernsey. You may not remember this before, but it was just a couple of weeks ago. We were talking again about the Anglican Church and about the Episcopal Church USA. And there was this priceless quote from Bishop Guernsey, who his story is, as you heard there, a bishop in the Episcopal Church USA who decided that he could not put up with the liberal direction of his church body any longer. And in order to do what he could, he was willing to submit to the authority of the Ugandan bishop, and now he is a bishop under the authority of the Bishop of Uganda. He's a bishop in the Ugandan Anglican Church. He left the Episcopal Church USA altogether, and he did it as a matter of conscience. Now, see, there's another way that this can happen. They mentioned it at the end of that NPR piece. The other way it can happen, entire bishoprics, entire diocese, can just pick up and say, we're going to leave. But that's not what they want to do. What they want to do is stay and see their church repent of its false teaching and return to the truth. It really is the last-ditch effort for a whole bishopric or a diocese to pick up and say, we gotta go. Now, one thing that the Anglicans value, and they rightly value this, the Episcopal Church USA takes this to an extreme. They value the unity of the church. But Guernsey's been quoted as saying, if it's just an artificial, made-up, man-made unity that papers over their significant differences regarding the gospel, he wants no part of it. And he's right. There's the kind of unity that Christ promises to the church, which is unity in the truth. And there's the kind of unity that, sad to say, so many denominations settle for, which is, let's just agree to disagree and put our differences aside and talk about what we agree in and rather than what we disagree about. That's not true unity. That's not unity in the truth. That's a man-made unity. And you know what you get out of man-made unity? All it can deliver to you is just whatever man can deliver to you. It can't deliver the real benefits of the kind of unity that Christ promises to his church. Issues Etc. is brought to you in part today by Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, where they're going to be hosting an annual Good Shepherd Institute. It's the premier conference on worship. It's going to be November the 4th through the 6th. Find out more about Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. I did have someone email me last week and say, where's the What's New section under your website? And they had the wrong website. It's issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and information about the Good Shepherd Institute, November the 4th through the 6th. You can also give them a call, area code 260-452-2256, 260-452-2256.
I believe it's time for me to fly.
Well, that's what some evangelicals are saying. Yesterday we heard James Dobson vowing that he was not going to vote or support a presidential candidate who would, in any way, shape, matter, or form, compromise on the life issue. He speaks for a lot of social conservatives, by the way, not just evangelical Christians. They're concerned that they don't have a front runner in the GOP or in the Democratic Party who will defend life. It's one of their biggest concerns. There's also the concern of the definition of marriage that goes along with it. Now, we heard Dobson on it yesterday, and he was very willing to admit to Sean Hannity, look, this is a hard problem, and I don't know what I'm going to do. Hannity said, well, what if by not voting for the front runner and compromising on these issues, you get someone like Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama elected? And he said, you know, I don't know, but I know what I can't do. And he's hoping for someone to emerge that he can support, that he can vote for. Is this you? Are you that kind of a voter who says, look, these issues are important, and I just can't bring myself to compromise, even if it means that I might be seeing to it that someone who is truly pro-choice makes it into the White House? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's Thursday, the 11th of October. We're coming to you live in our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Well, we just got done with the GOP debate, and for the first time we saw on the same stage, all talking pretty much on the same subjects, the three who appear to be the frontrunners. Rudolph Giuliani, he polls very well. Mitt Romney, we talked about him earlier today. And then they've called him the dark horse or the latecomer to the candidates' dais, Fred Thompson. They're all there. They're all looking good. They're all sounding good. They're all jabbing at one another a little bit. They're having their little fights in the media. But many people are looking at those three and saying, can I vote for any of those front runners? Here's a wrap-up of how it looks now in the GOP frontrunner line from NBC News.
New developments in the Republican presidential campaign. Rudy Giuliani and Mitt Romney are increasingly trying to make it a two-man race, and we certainly saw it in this week's debate when they attacked each other over taxes.
I control taxes.
Sorry.
I brought taxes down by 17%. Under him, taxes went up 11% per capita. I led. He lagged.
Sir, rebuttal here. Final rebuttal.
It's a nice line, but it's baloney. Mayor, you got to check your facts. No taxes. I did not increase taxes in Massachusetts. I lowered taxes.
NBC News political director Chuck Todd joins us now with our first read on politics. So, Chuck, obviously these two trying to make it a two-man race, but can they effectively ignore the elephant in the room by the name of Fred Thompson?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The interesting part of this was Giuliani's decision to sort of engage Romney. You know, for the longest time, Romney had been trying to turn this into a two-person race because Romney is afraid of getting dragged into a fight with Thompson. You know, Romney and Thompson are both vying for the more conservative voters in the Republican primary. Romney and Thompson could wind up in a very close race, for instance, in Iowa. Thompson, I think their folks would like to spend more time in Iowa and see how well they do. What's changed this week was Giuliani's decision to engage Romney. Part of that could very well be that Giuliani sees an opening in New Hampshire and a possibility to overtake Romney in New Hampshire, which is, I think, what got this started. So, look, a two-person, you know, sometimes when you see two candidates rise above, start beating each other up, both of them rise up. Sometimes the two of them beat each other up, they tear each other down, and the third candidate not being touched by the mud, in this case Fred Thompson or maybe even a John McCain, they end up pulling this off. I think that's what the Thompson folks hope at this point. Obviously, Rudy and Romney have made the calculation that, you know what, we'll fight each other because it's now just down to us.
On the Democratic side, every couple of months we hear the buzz surrounding Al Gore. Will he? Won't he? And now with expectations that he will win the Nobel Peace Prize tomorrow, if that happens, are we going to see the pressure increase a bunch for him to enter the race?
I think we will. I mean, it's been a standard sort of about every two or three months, like clockwork, a Gore boomlet. A Nobel Prize certainly would add to that. Gore's folks themselves add to it because they never say he's not running. It's always he has no intention to run or all those weird wiggle words that, you know, they've made us all cynical over the years to never believe these guys that they're not running until filing deadlines pass. But if he does win it, you will see another boomlet again. And that's really not good for Obama and Edwards. The more that Gore's talked about, it will lead to this idea that, you know what, maybe the Democrats who aren't supporting Clinton were worrying she's getting too far away and have decided that neither Obama or Edwards fit the bill. We got to find another anti-Hillary, and then that's where the Gore boomlet comes in. We'll see. The other calculation of this, it may be that Gore enjoys the talk and the chatter because it brings extra attention to his issues and, more importantly, will make his endorsement in a primary matter just a little bit more. Gore has promised that if he doesn't run, that he would probably endorse in the primary. And those folks that follow this very closely know that Mr. Gore and Mrs. Clinton aren't exactly very close.
Yeah. All right, Chuck Todd, thank you.
You got it.
You know, I don't know a lot of social conservatives that are interested in voting for Al Gore. They're looking at the GOP ticket and they're saying to themselves, what do? We've got a very popular and perhaps electable Rudolph Giuliani. but he is soft in his, he has soft support for gay marriage. Soft support, I say. He is, sounds exactly like John Kerry on the issue of abortion. Personally opposed, but doesn't think it should be illegal. Doesn't have, but he says, oh, I will appoint strict constructionist judges. Of course, it's been pointed out, it was yesterday by James Dobson, that those judges that he appointed when he had the power to do so, at least at the small level of New York, not good. Not good. So you've got Mitt Romney. He's right on the life issue and right on the gay marriage issue, but he's come to those issues slowly over time. And his state, his former state where he was governor, has gay marriage. And then you've got Fred Thompson, who on many of these issues is somewhat unknown. So are you, like a lot of social conservatives, saying, no one's emerged who I can vote for in good conscience, or I'm going to have to hold my nose if I pull the R lever? Do they still have levers? No, they don't have levers. I'm going to have to hold my nose if I punch the R button or Chad. Was it a Chad? Yes, that they used to call them. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Here's Al, who's calling from Dittmer, Missouri. Hi, Al.
Hey. I heard that O'Reilly interview with Dr. Dobson.
Yeah.
And the obvious question that wasn't asked was, if somebody agrees with you 100% on every issue, the social issues, the tax issues, the Second Amendment issues, but he is a member of the Ku Klux Klan, would you vote for him? And there is a line that you will not cross. You say, I will not vote for a Klan member. I will not vote for somebody who supports Jim Crow laws. And I will not vote for someone who allows the murder of babies.
Al, thank you very much. You know, I think that even though the question was not asked, you're absolutely right. Dr. Dobson did give that the answer to that question when he said in that interview, it was 19 years ago, I went to Washington, I gathered with a bunch of pro-life people at the mall in Washington, I pledged on that day that I would never again cast a compromise vote where I would vote for someone who would permit the killing of unborn children. And he says, I've got to stay true to that pledge. Okay, you've rightly framed the question here. Because someone says, okay, abortion is important, but we got to compromise to get our man in the White House. All right, what if Rudolph Giuliani were Rudolph Giuliani in every other respect, but he was a member of the Klan? What if Rudolph Giuliani was Ronald Reagan, but he was a member of the Klan? You see, there is a line that people aren't willing to cross. You say, well, I couldn't vote for someone who'd bring back Jim Crow. Well, how is that really morally, ethically any different from someone who would permit Roe to continue unabated? Well, very recently, Andrea Mitchell of NBC News interviewed Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council on the future of social conservatives in the GOP. Here's what he had to say.
Social conservatives helped put President Bush in the White House twice, but now some are so unhappy with the current crop of Republican candidates, they're talking about backing a third-party candidate instead. Joining us now, Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council. Tony, thanks very much for joining us. Your organization is not supporting a third party now, but you and other conservatives are having a hard time finding a candidate you can fall in love with. Why is that? What's wrong with Fred Thompson, for instance?
Well, Andrea, really, there's many options. In fact, there's a half a dozen of good options. What hasn't happened is that the support has not gravitated toward one particular candidate. The discussion of a support of a third party candidate really came about as a discussion of an if-then situation. If the party were to signal retreat from its defense of the unborn by nominating a pro-abortion rights candidate, then we would stand our ground and support a pro-life third-party candidate. But we see that as way down the road. There are at least a half a dozen candidates that have been talking about the values issues, about life, about marriage, about family. In fact, we'll have all of the Republican candidates at our event in Washington in less than 2 weeks, October the 19th to the 21st.
Tony, when you look at the three front runners, they all have created problems for you with past statements about abortion. You've got Mitt Romney, the former governor of Massachusetts being praised, ironically, by the log cabin Republicans for having Massachusetts values in an ad that they've just put up. The gay Republicans who say that he supported gay rights, he supported abortion when he was the Massachusetts governor. So he's flip-flopped on that, according to his critics in the social conservative field. You've got Rudy Giuliani as mayor of New York, the same deal. And now Fred Thompson, who has been criticized for lobbying for abortion rights in the past. If any one of those three are the nominee, do you then split off?
Well, I think the only one who has specifically charted out a policy position that is pro-abortion rights is Rudy Giuliani. I think that Governor Romney has changed his positions. I spent a lot of time with him even when he was governor in Massachusetts. And it's okay for people to change their positions when they come about a change of idea of what policy should be and the value of human life. And I think he's made a genuine transition to that. I don't see it as a flip-flop. I think he changed. And I think he's been one of the most forceful in talking about these issues. Senator Thompson, you had George Allen on a few minutes ago who talked about his record, and Senator Thompson does have a solid record on the life issue, and both Romney and Thompson, along with Senator Huckabee Governor Huckabee and Senator Brownback and others that are in this race, even Senator McCain, have staked out pro-life positions.
So bottom line, are you saying that if Rudy Giuliani is the nominee, and he is the front runner nationally, that if Rudy Giuliani is the nominee, you are going to find another option? Is he an unacceptable nominee unless, let's say, he chooses somebody like Mike Huckabee as a running mate?
Well, no, the line, I think, has been drawn by many social conservatives. In fact, there was a Rasmussen poll last week that showed that 27% of Republicans would vote for a third-party pro-life candidate if it were a head-to-head between Giuliani and Clinton. You know, I think this message we're
hearing...
Wouldn't
that just elect Hillary Clinton if she were the nominee?
Well, I think you have to realize, Andrea, that many social conservatives came into the political process, found a home in the Republican Party because it stated a defense for human life, the sanctity of human life. That's why they've been there. That's why they've worked for the Republican Party. And if the Republican Party changes, they're not going to stay around. If the party leaves its pro-life footing, then those folks are going to leave the party.
So Rudy Giuliani has to have a Mitt Romney-like conversion to be acceptable to you as the nominee.
Well, I think what we're looking for, what we have to, the Republican Party, if they want the full support of the base, they're going to have to do more than simply sing the simple ABC song, Anybody But Clinton. They're going to have to put forth someone who unifies the three key elements of the conservative movement, the fiscal conservatives, the foreign policy conservatives, and the social conservatives. And key to gathering the support of social conservatives is advancing a culture of life. And if you have a candidate that does not do that for the Republican Party, I don't believe you can be successful.
All right, Tony Perkins, thank you very much. Speaking from a very important part of the Republican base.
So do you agree or disagree with Tony Perkins that if, in fact, the Republican Party puts forth a pro-choice candidate, and that could be Rudolph Giuliani, that a third party is actually an option for social conservatives? Are you one of those kind of social conservatives that will say, look, it's not about having the perfect candidate, but on this life issue, if my party, and I speak here as a social conservative, not necessarily as a Republican, if my party puts forth a pro-choice presidential candidate, it's time to find another party. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. This break is a great time to call. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. A little more audio open lines after this.
Where Christianity meets culture. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Hello, this is Kay Meyer of Family Shield. God's Word tells us to sanctify Christ as Lord in your heart, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. Join us next time as we help individuals learn to discern truth from error in today's world.
Saturday morning at 11 on AM 850 KFUO.
Our guests on the next Focus on the Family are Lisa Turkhurst, author of Capture His Heart and co-founder of Proverbs 31 Ministries, and her husband Art. They'll share candidly about God's intervention in their marriage, telling how they learned to communicate effectively through the ups and downs of their relationship. Tune in for a practical and encouraging discussion on the next Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Creation Ministry. We're like pioneers.
Answers with Ken Ham, whose ministry has opened a large creation museum and planetarium near Cincinnati, Ohio. In many countries, Ken, including your homeland of Australia, the early pioneers had to forge their way across some rugged territory and, of course, facing many barriers. Now, are you saying that our ministry is somewhat comparable?
Well, Mark, you've summed it up quite nicely. But let me explain further. When the pioneers went to new areas, they had to do a lot of foundational work before they could produce crops for food. For example, they had to clear the land of rocks and trees, plow the ground to prepare it for seeding and so on. It was only after a lot of hard work they could actually reap a harvest. Now, I believe this is similar to the situation we're in today concerning the preaching of the gospel. Because the church has compromised with the teaching of evolution in millions of years, there's a strong barrier to the gospel in society. Evolution in millions of years teaching is like rocks and weeds that cover the landscape and thus stops seeds being sown for harvest. And like pioneers, we need to rid the land of the rocks and weeds of evolution and millions of years and prepare the ground by teaching the truth of the history of life from Genesis. In this way, the seed of the gospel can be planted and bear fruit.
Many Christians believe that the earth is millions of years old and that suffering and death have occurred before Adam sinned. For the problems with that belief, read Ken Ham's free booklet on death and suffering. It's at AnswersRadio.com.
For many years, the reach of AM 850 KFUO was largely confined to most of Missouri and central and southern Illinois. Now through the internet, KFUO is reaching every state in the Union, as was evidenced by an e-gift we recently received from Joshua in Kahului, Hawaii. Thanks, Joshua, for your generosity and support. It shows that folks everywhere in America and around the world are showing support for and communicating with their friends at AM 850 KFUO.
Go, my children, with my blessing, never alone.
Go, my children, with my blessing. It's one of the many songs on a new recording titled The Temba Girls with the Aaron Bodie Group. Jazz recording artist Aaron Bodie teamed with the girls' choir in South Africa to produce this new CD. And proceeds from this recording will benefit the Temba Trust, a nonprofit foundation that operates a girls' school and other educational and youth programs that serve South Africa's rural poor. For more information on the Temba Girls with the Aaron Bodie Group, check out our homepage, issuesetc.org. For a $25 donation to LCMS World Relief, you can get a CD with great music and also help South African children. issuesetc.org, the Temba Girls with the Aaron Bodie Group.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Half hour left in the program. A little audio open lines, and we'll talk with Walt Snyder about Philip the Deacon, remembered on this day in the church's calendar. The question I put on the table for you, now that we've heard from Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council, he's concerned, Dr. Dobson is concerned, other social conservatives are concerned that it might be time, if not to form, but maybe to vote for a third party in 2008, especially if someone like Rudolph Giuliani makes it to the nomination of the Republican Party. He is pro-choice. Are you that kind of social conservative? I want to hear from you. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Even if it would mean the election of someone like Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, both very pro-choice. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. It's Thursday, the 11th of October. Now, you know, Jeff, you used to do the little running around Edwardsville politics kind of thing, didn't you? When you were younger, you were like little Mr. Local Politics.
Yes, when I was very much younger,
okay,
like in high school.
Okay, so when you were in high school, you were young Republican, you were out there running around, right?
I suppose
canvassing,
so. I suppose so.
Volunteering.
I've never voted straight ticket in my life.
You never have?
No. So, I trust no parties.
All right. So what
kind of social conservative are you? Are you kind of social conservative who, just imagine this scenario, Rudolph Giuliani gets the nomination. It looks like he very well could get the nomination with the Republican Party. The nominee has a tremendous influence on the platform of that party. When they meet in convention, the platform of the party that will be accepted by the convention, of course, these are media events, but they still have a platform, will be influenced largely by Rudolph Giuliani, which means chances are they're going to soften their view on the life issue if Giuliani is the nominee. Can you vote for Giuliani that way? You're willing to split your ticket every different way on other issues. Can you vote for Giuliani?
I don't think any of our listeners really care what I think.
No, they take you. Your guidance is indispensable to
them. You know, I got an interesting.
I have had more people tell me that they listen to the program and they like what I have to say, but they hang on your every word.
I don't believe that.
I do.
But secondly, I've talked about this issue, my skepticism of a Giuliani campaign and the future of the Republican Party, and the argument was, well, you're going to get, you know
Hillary Clinton elected.
The two justices are probably going to be in this next term.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
But, I mean, what makes me think Rudolph Giuliani is going to, appoint pro-life judges just because they're strict constructionists?
He can appoint anyone he wants. And if he has a history of trying to have a successful nomination, he will most certainly get a nominee to the Supreme Court confirmed by the present Senate if that is anything less than John Roberts or anything else that we saw in the last term.
Here's another question for our listeners. What if, okay, it's Giuliani at the top of the ticket, but he chooses like a strong pro-life guy like Mike Huckabee or Sam Brownback as his VP? Will that appease you enough to vote for Rudolph Giuliani?
Can you hold your nose on the top of the ticket if the bottom of the ticket for the GOP is very pro-life? Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, or call 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. Come out tomorrow. We're going to be broadcasting live from German Days at the Sim here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. I think I heard Jeff talking to someone during the break who was wondering about German Days and plans to be there. It's free. It's open to the public. Very interesting. German Days at the Sim tomorrow and Saturday. For more information, check out the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org. Go there tonight, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section for German Days. We should call it Uwe Simonetto's German Days. His name has to be attached to this because our listeners love Uwe Simonetto.
Everybody loves Uwe.
That's true.
In a rare live Friday broadcast of Issues Etc.
It is
tomorrow.
Probably of all my time, and I'm going into my 10th year broadcasting Issues Etc. I think we've only done 3 or 4 live Friday broadcasts. So that might be incentive enough for you to come out. We were looking forward to seeing you there. It's audio open lines 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, issuesetc@kfuo.org. The question I've laid on the table, what if someone like Rudolph Giuliani, pro-choice, is the top of the ticket for the GOP? What are you going to do as a voter? Steve's waiting in his car. Hi, Steve.
I don't know what I'd do with Giuliani. Maybe I'll go watch Saturday Night Live skits of political skits instead of voting. Sometimes I think that's a better alternative.
Would you actually sit it out?
I don't know. Giuliani was a fantastic mayor. I spent a lot of time in New York City when he was mayor on business, and he did a fantastic job there. But it's sort of like this: he was a benevolent dictator in the city. So I'm not sure about president. That's a whole different realm. But you made the comment about the holding your nose if you like the person underneath. It's sort of like saying, I really think that the Episcopal Church is all screwed up, but I really like my local priest, so I'm going to stay true to the Episcopal Church for my priest, despite the fact that the rest of the denomination is going to hell in a handbasket.
It's a fitting analogy. Thank you very much, Steve. I ask this question because it's a question that I actually ask myself. If the platform changes with the nominee, like Giuliani, on the life issue, can I remain a registered Republican, much less vote?
Or is it the third party for me, or independence, or something like that? Larry's calling from his car. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
Very well.
Well, I would have to say that in my mind, the abortion issue is number one, and so I would never vote for a candidate, Republican, Democrat, independent, who was not pro-life. And as far as voting for, you know, perhaps if he had Sam Brown back as his running mate, Rudolph Giuliani, I mean, in my mind, that's just, wasn't it John Adams or somebody that said the vice president was one of the most, I guess, ineffective or worthless positions in the U.S. government? I mean, you know, I think history shows that VPs that don't really endorse the platform of the president are usually kind of brushed aside and marginalized. So I just don't see that wouldn't pass. That wouldn't satisfy me at all.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. You know, I'm thinking, how would the bottom of the ticket change people's minds if they say, well, I can't vote for Rudolph Giuliani, but Rudolph Giuliani and Sam Brown back? Oh, I can vote for that. Well, what is the vice president going to do? Is he going to nominate judges? No. He's going to do exactly what Giuliani lets him do. Now, he might let him do a lot of things, but he's not going to nominate judges. He's not going to sign legislation or veto legislation. So the two areas where the president can really affect the country's direction in terms of the life issue, the VEEP, unless the president meets an untimely end, doesn't have any direct contact with it. Phil's calling from his car. Hi, Phil.
Hi. The abortion issue is very high on my list, so I wouldn't vote for him. But on Mitt Romney, I heard that he backed down a little bit on abortion and gay marriage. And, you know, this is a thing that Mormons are allowed to do. It's like they had a little teaching from the Masons, and my dad was a Mormon, and they're allowed to either have somebody lie for them or kind of mislead you for the greater good. And later on, if he got in, he would then, you know, change up a little bit and make it a priority.
Interesting. See, Mitt Romney is the other one that people are saying, well, and in fact, it was even a question asked Dobson, what about Mitt Romney? And he's like, well, I don't know about Mitt Romney yet. I got a problem with the fact that he's a Mormon, but he's got better values than Giuliani. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc at kfuo.org. This one comes from Josh in St. Louis. He writes, a few years ago, Cal Thomas spoke at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. I remember that. He said that the reason abortion became a political issue is because the church had failed to speak clearly on the issue. I happen to agree. You can't change social policies like abortion, definition of marriage, etc., by the one you elect president. I think that a presidential election is a reflection of the electorate. If you want presidential candidate who passes every litmus test on life issues, then you need a greater percentage of voters who agree with that viewpoint. Now, that's true. I got a response for that in a moment, though. But Josh goes on. He says, if James Dobson is voting none of the above, then he's signaling defeat over a year before the election. Unless you are a candidate running for office, you won't be voting for someone who agrees with you on every nuanced position, on every issue. Although I would point out, Josh, the difference between pro-choice and pro-life is not a nuance. It's the difference between life and death. For this reason, voting for any candidate is a compromise. That is also true, Josh. It's not a question of whether you will compromise. It's how much you will compromise. A push for a third-party candidate won't cause a pro-choice candidate to become a president. It will predict a pro-choice candidate winning the White House. If there isn't a good enough candidate for social conservatives, we've already lost, and there's nothing that can be done. A vote for a third party will send a message, but we will all seal the fate of a social conservatives in 2008. Well, don't count any voting bloc out until they're actually out. He concludes by saying, if all is truly lost for social conservatives in 2008, then Dobson and the gang need to focus on Congress instead of the White House, assuming that we will have a pro-choice president in 2009, will lead a pro-life Congress to challenge pro-choice judicial candidates and pass pro-life legislation. The problem is that there, Josh, as you probably well know, Senate confirms those nominees, and the Senate has proven intractable when it comes to the life issue. The House is different, but the Senate has proven intractable. Now, Charlie in Fort Collins, Colorado, Ticking off a conversation just a moment ago with Jeff says, I strongly believe that Issues Etc. listeners are far too intelligent and astute to value Jeff's political opinions. Although, Charlie, I would point out that Jeff, he's called it on a lot of things. I mean, I hear him talk between the breaks about matters political. He's called an awful lot of things that I didn't see coming. Charlie also says, of course, take my opinion with a grain of salt, because if both presidential candidates are pro-choice, I'll vote for Jeff. I didn't know you were running.
I'm running. No, I'm not going to say that. I'm a writing candidate.
No. You're the tiger candidate. That's what you are. You're the tiger candidate. It's the only party that you truly belong to.
First, are
the Tigers.
Am I right? I have to control Edwardsville first before I can go to Washington, D.C. Give me time, okay, Charlie?
Yes, the empire expands from Edwardsville out. And sooner or later, it will come to you, Charlie, even out in Fort Collins. Well, enough of that. Let's move on from matters political to matters theological. To Philip the Deacon, the church remembers this New Testament saint. There's not a lot of information on Philip the Deacon, but he does appear in a rather significant way in the book of Acts. Our guest here for the last few minutes of the program, Pastor Walt Snyder, pastor of Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Emma, Missouri, author of the blog Ask the Pastor. Pastor Snyder, welcome back.
Good to be back.
I do have to tell you, we were out in Kansas City a couple of years ago, and on our way back, we passed on the highway, Highway 70, the turnoff to Emma. My daughter happens to share that name. I had her get out of the car, stand underneath the sign for Emma, and took a picture of her. Just to make sure that we didn't pass that opportunity there. Emma's a sweet little town, just like my daughter.
Well, next time you come by, ring the bell and see if we're home. And if you are, we'll have you in for a cold drink.
Oh, that would be very nice. That would be very nice indeed. Philip the Deacon appears briefly and then reappears almost as briefly in the book of Acts. Tell us what we know about Philip the Deacon.
We know that he was one of the wait staff who the apostles assigned to take care of getting everybody fed. When they were being burdened by all of the social aspects of taking care of a large and diverse church, especially with the Hellenistic Jewish widows who were getting short shrift evidently because they were from out of town and they didn't speak the Aramaic of the land, and somebody needed to come up and talk for them. And so they appointed this group of deacons or servants who was going to see especially that they were taken care of in the food allotments, that they would be clothed and sheltered and all of the other things that they needed. And the two who we know the most about are Philip and then even more so perhaps about Stephen. And after that, it's pretty quiet.
So Philip is among those, is it the seven men of good repute?
Right.
And what is a deacon then in that context?
A deacon is one who is a servant. It's a minister. It's not a slave position if you're trying to equate it to any of a classical Greek understanding, but it's one who ministers under somebody else. And in the church traditionally, deacons have been some either lay or clergy position, depending on your understanding of it, but who worked underneath and in conjunction with the pastors to tend both the spiritual but especially to the physical needs of their flocks.
So this is why, at least in Philip's case, and perhaps in Stephen's case as well, we find Philip later actually preaching the gospel, kind of like the apostles preached the gospel.
Right, and it doesn't seem that either one of them set out to do it, but they were thrust into positions where their confession was compelled from them, and of course with Stephen that got him killed. With Philip, different things happened, but it could happen to any of us who have the gospel and who aren't afraid to speak it in certain situations. Converts may be gained or we may lose our lives.
We find Philip, after hearing of him being chosen by the church and the Holy Spirit to serve as a deacon, in a very interesting interchange with this man called Simon the Sorcerer in the region of Samaria. Tell us what goes on there.
Right. After the whole eighth chapter of Acts deals with this, Stephen had been murdered, and the church basically cut and ran. And hardly anybody stayed in Jerusalem besides the apostles and a few with them, and they, I imagine, were in pretty deep hiding. So Philip went into Samaria, which was the remnant of what had been the northern kingdom of Israel during the time of the divided kingdoms, and was ministering to the Samaritan people there, as Jesus had already done during his ministry. And obviously he didn't have any widows and orphans to take care of, but he was compelled to talk about Jesus. And so he started talking about him. Simon the magician, whether he was a true demonic magician who actually manipulated the spirits, or whether he was a shyster and sleight of hand man, we're not sure. But whatever it was, he was amazed that Philip could do even better than he does. And so he tried to get the power that Philip had and tried to buy it from him. And Philip rebuked him at such a thing, and saying that you can't buy the Holy Spirit, and called him to repentance for it, and because he said if not, you could be tottering on the brink of hell, basically. And it's funny because although Simon the magician after that became a believer, the name Simony, or the word Simony, stuck in the Christian church for Christian bishops and others who tried buying their offices. So he converted and forsook his sinful, greedy ways. But the name Simon, in his case, came in then as one who didn't do that and who tried to climb up the ladder of clergydom by paying off the person above you.
The most famous account there, again, in Acts, not too far along from that point you were talking about, wherein we find Philip is, of course, Philip meeting the Ethiopian eunuch on the road and then being whisked off by the Holy Spirit to preach someplace else, Azota, I believe. Tell us the story about Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch.
And even there, we don't know a whole lot. We're not even sure when we think of a eunuch. Technically, it's a castrated male, but a lot of people in those days were called eunuchs who were court officials, and it had become almost a class of person, but not necessarily one who had actually had the operation done, because I was looking through some things, and there were some eunuchs who actually had fathered children. So obviously they weren't eunuchs in the way we normally think of them, but he's definitely a trusted official with Candace, the queen. And whether it was really Ethiopia or whether it was the Sudan, because the political borders in those days aren't the same as they were right now, we're not quite sure where things go. But this man was already under the influence of the Old Testament scriptures. We don't see somebody who just out of the blue all of a sudden says, I want to learn about Jesus, but somebody who is reading Isaiah. And the Spirit leads Philip to listen to him and hear what he's saying, because everybody read out loud back then, and at the appropriate time to ask, do you understand what you're reading? And then he had the opening because the man didn't. He said, well, I can tell you about this, and so he did. And it's interesting that just like Jesus would do so often, he'd start exactly where they were, and from that point then, tell him everything about Jesus. And that one, obviously, the sheep led to the slaughter and the lamb before the shearer from Isaiah 52 and 53 with the suffering servant passages in there, the death and resurrection of the one who God sent to save his people. And so Philip said, well, Isaiah didn't die this way, but I know the one who did, and this is the good news about Jesus. And evidently he told him a lot in a fairly short period of time, because as they were going down the road, there was water, and the eunuch said, what prevents me from being baptized? And Philip evidently said, absolutely nothing. So they stopped the chariot, get him baptized, and sent him on the way. This man, I guess you could say, was a proto-Christian, because he already believed in the God of the Old Testament, but he didn't have the Holy Spirit come upon him yet, and he didn't know the Messiah until Philip proclaimed him to him. And from there on out, he carried the gospel with him. And there's a tradition in Ethiopia, especially before the communist government took over some years back, and then it went to anarchy after that, but when Haile Selassie and his predecessors were emperors there, that they were descended religiously from this interchange that happened right here, as they had earlier when the Queen of Sheba had visited Solomon, and that these two were the two big exchanges that had carried the word of the Lord God of Israel, and then of Jesus, the Son of God, down into Africa. And the Lion of Judah then was one of the official symbols of the emperors of Ethiopia, taking both the Old Testament connotation, and also then the New Testament with Jesus as being the lion who is seen in Revelation.
Finally, then, a brief mention of Philip. With only about a minute and a half here, Pastor Schneider, Philip appears later in conjunction with St. Paul on his final visit to Jerusalem. What do we know there with about a minute and a half?
He was evidently at home. He wasn't running around anymore, whether he was retired from being a deacon or whether he was between the duties that he had, and the deacons were most likely people who were fulfilling other tasks, was there and was hospitable and gave Paul and his traveling companions the opportunity there to come in and rest for a while. And while we were there, Luke remarks about the four daughters who Philip had who weren't married, who were prophets, and then another prophet came in and prophesied how Paul would be taken away in chains. Just so people know, though, this is not the same Philip who Jesus called to be a disciple. We know this because all of the apostles stayed in Jerusalem during the scattering. Philip has this name, and he's out being scattered. Also, why would one of the people who Jesus had specifically called to be an apostle then decide he didn't want to be an apostle anymore and was going to take up the lesser or the less spiritual task of serving the physical needs of the people? So unless somebody has clear evidence otherwise, there's no one who really seriously believes that this Philip is the same as Philip the evangelist, or Philip, rather, the apostle, and that they're two completely different people.
Then with only 30 seconds, what is the benefit for the church to remember on this day Philip the deacon?
That no matter what vocation God calls us into, he will always give us opportunities to speak up for the faith. And whether it's in the line at the grocery store or the movie theater or sitting around talking with people, it's amazing the number of opportunities the people give us. People invite us to talk to them, to comfort them. And Christians blow it so often by not bringing Jesus in as quickly and as firmly as they can, not just dumping him in there like, let me tell you about Jesus, but to work him in there when somebody says, how do you keep your peace of mind, or how do you get through this, or what do you suggest that I do? They're giving you permission. Take that permission and apply the Lord as best as you know how. If you don't get it perfectly, it's better than not getting him in there at all.
Walt Snyder is pastor of Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Emma, Missouri, and author of the blog Ask the Pastor. Thank you so much for being our guest, Walt.
Good to be back, Todd.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., join us as we broadcast live from German Days at the Sem. I'm going to call it Uwe Simonetto's German Days at the Sem. It's right there on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. Everyone is invited to attend. There is no registration or attendance fee. It's absolutely free. We're going to be broadcasting live from 3 to 6 tomorrow, a rare live Friday broadcast of Issues Etc. at Winneken Hall. If you want to know where that is, just as you get on campus, stop one of these nice seminarians and say, where's Winneken? They'll tell you. Our first topic tomorrow will be Islam in Germany with Pastor Albrecht Hauser of the Islam Institute in Germany. I'm Todd Wilkin. Looking forward to seeing you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.